It is Friday, August the 12th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Many thanks for joining us. Coming up, the latest on the situation in Syria.
Syria is territorially and politically very divided now, and various groups occupying different parts of the country.
Also ahead, Russia's involvement in Syria, U.S. politics, and what the presidential candidates are saying about the economy, plus the latest from Leanne Rimes. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norma. Russia is willing to discuss the lengthening of its 3-hour daily suspension of military action in the besieged Syrian city of Aleppo. That according to the United Nations, where they are also investigating reports that a bomb containing chlorine gas was used by the Syrian military in the area. For some analysis, my colleague Lori London speaks with Amin Cycle. He is director of the Center for Arab and Islamic Studies at Australian National University.
Not exactly clear, but we do know that the regime has used it before. That is the Assad regime. And this is not, if that's really the case, this is not the first time that the Assad regime has crossed the red line. I mean, it's done it before. And in 2013, it used chemical weapons, and that was established that the Assad regime had done it. Of course, that's what prompted President Obama to claim that the Assad regime had crossed the red line and he was going to inflict punitive measures on the Assad regime. Was diffused, and the issue was referred to the Congress, and Congress said no at the time. But I wouldn't be very surprised that the regime has again used these chlorine gas, which is really a form of chemical weapon that the regime probably still possess.
I know it's a complex issue when it comes to what is happening in Syria, because we've got the whole element of Russia seemingly to be doing everything it can to keep the Assad regime into power. Where does the United States go from here when it comes to the situation?
Well, I mean, as you said, it is a very complex situation, and the United States probably has missed the valuable opportunity that it had in 2013 and possibly 2014 before the Russians escalated their involvement and support of the Assad regime. I think something could have been done then, but I think that point has been really missed now. What the United States has been able to do, and I think with the support of a number of its allies, is to provide the Syrian rebels with better military equipment and perhaps some training. And we do understand from London that the British Special Forces have been seen on the ground in Syria, and I wouldn't be very surprised that also there may be special American forces operating. Lately, the rebels have had some success, and they have gained some territory, and that may well be as a result of the fact that they may have been better equipped and better trained.
But even if they're gaining ground, can they really ever succeed as long as Bashar Assad is in power and Russia's helping him stay in power?
I don't think so. I don't think there is a military solution to this conflict. I think there has to be ultimately a political settlement. And I think that is what the Assad regime and its international supporters, and more importantly, Russia, recognize. But at what point that's likely to happen, and whether the Russians really going to come to the party, we know that Secretary of State John Kerry He's been pushing very hard for a political settlement. But also, at the same time, let's not forget that Syria is territorially and politically very divided now, and various groups occupying different parts of the country. Even if the Assad regimes succeed in clearing them out, then it would be still very difficult for it to establish its threat right across the country, because there will still be remnants of these forces which will be engaging in guerrilla warfare, suicide bombing, and everything else. And also, the Assad regime will be presiding over a totally ruined country, and to rebuild Syria will be billions and billions of dollars, and that's unlikely to come from the international supporters of the Assad regime. That is Russia and the Islamic Republic of Iran. And I think it will really need international help and will need Western help. And I think that is something to which the Syrian regime would have to be alerted. And I think that's what the United States should really work towards.
Amin Saikal of Australia's National University speaking with International Edition's Laurie London. As I mentioned earlier, Russia's defense ministry says it's implementing a daily humanitarian pause in military operations around Aleppo by halting air and artillery attacks from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. local time. UN Humanitarian Chief Stephen O'Brien says a regular 48-hour ceasefire in the fighting will need to be implemented to meet all the city's humanitarian needs. Regional analyst Anthony Billingsley of the University of New South Wales tells my colleague Victor Beatty he believes the UN proposal of 48 hours is more realistic if humanitarian concerns are really paramount.
It seems to me that it must fit into some sort of response to difficulties that the Syrians and the Russians have been having around Aleppo over the last couple of days, where the siege, the blockade has been broken, and at the same time, the government-controlled area of Aleppo is in itself risking being isolated. And so I think they're probably trying somehow or other to slow down rebel advances, to give the Assad government time to get forces into position, etc. But in terms of providing substantial aid to, well, we're talking 2 million people, they're not going to achieve anything with those short breaks.
We have a French press agency report that indicates that in rebel districts where an offensive has broken a government siege for the first time in nearly a month, markets in opposition-held districts of Aleppo are bustling with eager shoppers snatching up vegetables, chicken, and even cigarettes. Obviously, there is some aid getting in.
This is the most extraordinary thing about this conflict. I've been in Turkey where I encountered Christian Syrians whose job it was to cross the border into Turkey, trading stuff and then taking it back and crossing lines, fighting lines, into one side or other of the conflict. It's porous to a point. There is stuff getting through, there is trade going on, people are producing stuff, but it's very limited. The capacity for people to get adequate food and especially the health care is very limited.
There's an analysis piece on Reuters which says in breaking a Syrian government siege on opposition areas of Aleppo, insurgents have set back President Assad's hopes of using Russian air power to reclaim a vital city and speed the end of the 5-year conflict. What do you think?
Yes, I think so. It's been a real problem for Assad. He was sounding quite confident, and as were the Russians, I think, that the blockade that they'd established was going to be the end of it. And this would have been a very significant symbolic, but not just symbolic, achievement for the government. But instead, what they're faced with is the prospect that their own part of the city is going to be isolated, and they're going to have to fight to regain access to it.
Anthony Billingsley of the University of New South Wales speaking with VOA's Victor Beatty. Later in the program, U.S. politics and allegations involving the Islamic State. And among the other stories we're following here on The Voice of America, Russian envoy saying there is no going back on Crimea. Major setback reported in Nigeria with new cases of polio. Plus, Pakistan-based rebel leader stages an anti-India protest. Get those stories, a lot more, at voanews.com and also on the VOA mobile app. Human Human rights activists have joined a call by some members of Pakistan's Hindu community to protest alleged forced conversion of Hindu girls to Islam. A protest took place Thursday on what was officially marked as National Minorities Day in Pakistan. VOA's Ayesha Tanzim has our report.
The call to protest in various cities of Pakistan, as well as in Toronto, New York and Houston, was initiated by activist Kapil Dev on social media and singled out an individual famously known as Mia Mittu as the prime culprit for such alleged conversions.
He's a symbol of terror. He's a symbol of forced conversion. And Hindu from that area, they cannot dare to even utter a single word.
Mittu, whose real name is Mia Abdul Haq, is an influential politician and Muslim cleric in Pakistan's Sindh province, home to most of the Hindus who live in Pakistan. The country's Hindu community has long alleged that he provides protection to those who kidnap young Hindu girls, often under 18, and forcefully converts them to Islam before they are married off to their abductors. Mittu strongly denies the allegations. He says the girls who come to him are mature and convert of their own free will. Hindus are demanding a change in the law and a mechanism for conversion that could help determine free will. Ayesha Tanzim, VOA News, Islamabad.
And for more on that story, plus all the news, go to our website at voanews.com. This is VOA.
Democracy in action. That's what the U.S. presidential election is all about. Who is going to be the new president of the United States come November 8th? Tune in to VOA's coverage of the 2016 presidential election. Reports, expert analysis, and more. Professional, up-to-the-minute coverage that can't be found anywhere else. Right here on VOA.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, and on my program Jazz America, I carry on the tradition begun decades ago by the great Willis Conover by exploring the wonders of a century of jazz history. I'll cover it all from Dixieland to swing to bebop to modal, free jazz, fusion, world jazz, contemporary, and beyond. Plus, you'll hear the words of the artists themselves as they tell their incredible stories. Join me for Jazz America, Saturdays and Sundays at 13 hours Universal Time, online at voanews.com and the Voice of America.
This is VOA's International Edition. We turn now to U.S. politics. Democratic Party presidential candidate Hillary Clinton says her economic proposals will help a wide range of workers. Her remarks came during a policy address to supporters at a defense manufacturing plant in the Midwestern state of Michigan.
And as Secretary of State, I fought hard for American businesses to get a fair shot around the world and to stop underhanded trading practices like currency manipulation and the theft of intellectual property. So as president, I will stand up to China and anyone else who tries to take advantage of American workers and companies.
My colleague Michael Lippin spoke with Shai Akabas, who is director of the fiscal policy at Washington-based Bipartisan Policy Center. He asked him what's new in Clinton's speech.
Well, you know, I think she hit a lot of themes that she's been hitting throughout this campaign, which is contrasting herself with her opponent, of course, and trying to frame her policies around a middle-class agenda that is going to produce economic growth and also ensuring that, as she puts it, that the highest income taxpayers pay their fair share. And so a lot of her proposals were on the tax side of things, and she proposes to change elements of the tax code that would increase taxes on the top 1% by and large, maybe a little bit larger group than that, but it's really focused at the very top of the income spectrum.
And how does Clinton's approach to taxing the highest income earners compare with what Trump was talking about earlier this week?
So Donald Trump, in contrast, has proposed to substantially reduce the top marginal tax rate. Right now, it's just under 40%. He proposes to lower that down to, I think the latest is 33%. And so he is actually proposing to reduce taxes on the highest income taxpayers. Now, a big difference between the two plans is that Donald Trump's plan would be a significant overall tax cut. Originally, it was scored at around $10 trillion over 10 years. He's since made some modifications, and so I think it would be in the ballpark of a few trillion dollars, whereas Secretary Clinton proposes to raise additional revenues of about $1 trillion over 10 years. So they go a little bit in the opposite direction in terms of the impact on government revenue and therefore government debt.
And how do you see the impact of both plans on the overall economy? What are they trying to go for?
So there's an argument to be made that reducing taxes and people's marginal tax rates could spur economic growth because it'll increase investment, increase labor. But I think there's also an argument to be made on the other side that we already have large deficits and a large pile of debt that we have as a country that's equal to about 70-some-odd percent of our GDP, of our total economy. And that's quite significant and rising more in the future. And so I think taking into account the impact that these plans would have on that debt in the future and putting in a tax reform that both encourages economic growth but also helps us to improve our fiscal picture are important steps to consider.
And do you think that both candidates have elements of that in their plans?
I think they certainly both have elements of that. I think Donald Trump's plan focuses more on what he would consider the growth aspect, that lowering tax rates will encourage more economic growth and grow the pie, per se, whereas Secretary Clinton, I think, focuses a little bit more on the bringing in additional revenue to the federal government by having higher income taxpayers contribute more. She would probably argue that elements of her plan are also meant to spur economic growth, but I think there is a contrast between the two in terms of how they view the tax code and what its goals and specific aspects should be.
Well, just one more area I'd like to look at, and that is trade. Hillary Clinton did reemphasize her opposition to the Trans-Pacific Partnership. How different is her approach to that than Trump, who also is against the TPP?
You know, it's interesting, and it's a good question because I've been listening a lot to their language over the past several months on this issue. And while they talk about it a little bit differently, they do seem to have both ended up in a similar position. And I think that's partly because of the political reality is just that people have come out with a very visceral reaction to these trade deals and the way they've been portrayed. And the case with trade in general is that while it's generally good for overall economic growth for any country, our country, trade deals can often have adverse impacts on specific pockets or specific populations, specific occupations. And so the drawbacks tend to be concentrated among small populations, whereas the benefits tend to be dispersed over the entire population. And so I think they both ended up in a position where they are generally against the trade deals that we have in place now or are currently negotiating. But certainly Secretary Clinton and I think also Donald Trump have said that they are both pro-trade in general. It's just that they want the right trade deals for the United States. And so without getting into a lot of granularity, they've placed themselves in relatively similar positions on the spectrum.
And as Shia Kavis, he is director of the fiscal policy at Washington-based Bipartisan Policy Center. He was speaking with International Edition's Michael Lippin. Time now to see what's happening on social media. International Edition's G. Abby Lee here with the latest. Hi, G.
Hi, Steve. The online community is talking about what GOP presidential candidate Donald Trump said during his rally in Florida Wednesday and also during interviews on Thursday. And a lot of people were also not happy with who was attending the rally. But we'll get into that a bit later. Trump not only insinuated but flat out argued President Barack Obama is a founder of terrorist group ISIS. The controversial quote reads like this: "In many respects, they honor President Obama. He's a founder of ISIS. He founded ISIS. And I would say the co-founder would be crooked Hillary Clinton." He doubled down on that comment during multiple interviews on Thursday, and most notably with conservative radio host Hugh Hewitt. Hewitt suggested Trump hadn't meant his statement to be taken literally. But the candidate cut him off and said, "No, I meant he is a founder of ISIS. I do. He's the most valuable player. I give him the Most Valuable Player award.
I understand, G. So what's the reaction like?
Well, as you can imagine, people's reactions to the news really depends on the media account they're following. But, of course, there is one person who has vested interest in this situation, and that's his Democratic rival, Clinton. She tweeted, "No, Barack Obama is not the founder of ISIS." More than 11,000 people liked that comment. A longer version of that tweet is available on her Facebook page. She wrote, "It can be difficult to muster outrage as frequently as Donald Trump should cause it, but a smear against President Obama requires it. No, Barack Obama is not the founder of ISIS. Anyone willing to sink so low, so often, should never be allowed to serve as our commander-in-chief." As for Trump, he hasn't tweeted about his comment or reaction to Clinton's statement.
And what else was trending about the rally?
The fact that a disgraced former congressman sat behind Trump during the rally also caught people's attention. We're talking about Mark Foley, who resigned in 2006 after sending sexual explicit messages to underage teenage boys. Steve, back to you.
And many thanks to you, G, our own social media guru, G. Abby Lee. By the way, you can follow G on Twitter at G. Abby Lee. I'm there as well at VOA Norman. And our program, International Edition, can be found on Twitter at VOA _IE. This is VOA.
This is BizBeat.
Can you gain customers by taking something away from them? That's what the owner of a cocktail bar is trying to do in the United Kingdom. Steve Tyler installed a metal shield called a Faraday cage, which stops wireless signals at the gin tub in Brighton, making it a dead zone for mobile phones.
I just wanted people to enjoy their night out in my bar without being interrupted by their phones.
Customers seem to like the idea.
I think it's a brilliant idea. Because let's face it, we all spend too much time on our phones.
Faraday cage, it sounds like a great idea, actually forcing people to be socially networking with the person they've actually gone to the bar with.
Experts say that since a Faraday cage doesn't jam cell phone signals but only blocks them, it's legal to use. Other bars and restaurants around the world have applied similar methods to encourage people to put away their mobile phones and engage with their fellow humans. For VOA's BizBeat, I'm Martin Seacrest.
This is VOA's International Edition. Many thanks, everyone, for joining us. And we turn to the Olympic Games in Rio de Janeiro. In women's gymnastics, American Simone Biles takes gold, with American Ali Raisman winning silver and Russia's Alia Mustafa getting bronze. Big night for them. Also a huge night for American swimmer Michael Phelps, who took gold in the men's 200-meter individual medley. It is his 22nd career Olympics gold medal. Kosuke Agino of Japan won the silver, and Wang Shun of China has the bronze. In the 100 meters freestyle for women, American swimmer Simone Manuel and Canada's Penny Olsiak tied for gold. That's an unusual event. Sarah Sjöström of Sweden taking bronze. And Britain won the first gold medal of the track cycling program, rallying past New Zealand, that is, in the final of the men's team sprint by the slimmest of margins. All of that late on Thursday. Singer Leanne Rimes has been in the business, music business that is, since she was only 11. The multi-Grammy winner has a new song out there, a new album, and she's allowing her to finally sing some of her heart and soul songs. We got that story now from International Edition's David Byrd.
All of these lines across my face tell you the story of who I am.
Leanne Rimes has been in the music business since she was only 11. She won two Grammy Awards for her song Blue and as the Best New Artist in 1997. But now Rimes is signed with a new record company and is about to release her 16th studio album. She says that fans can look forward to hearing more of the real Leanne Rimes.
And I'm from Mississippi originally, and I moved from there when I was really young, but I didn't realize how much of, like, the you know, gospel part of the South, the rock and soul of it all was in my blood. And that just seemed to be what naturally came out for me on this record.
The first song from the new album, The Story, is a ballad about love and heartbreak. But Leanne says that the whole record is not just about love and loss.
It's a very epic record in terms of sound. We have this fantastic background singers all over the record, and it's very soulful. So I think this story just gives a hint into a newer sound for me. But when you hear the record, it's like it's completely different.
Leanne says she always knew this type of record was in her heart, but she was obligated to produce a certain kind of album because of her former contract. But now Leanne says that she thinks fans will like what they hear.
It's pretty powerful to make that, you know, to make music from your soul is like make it from a completely different place. And I have done that before as a songwriter, but never, I think, with the sound of the record truly being like something that came out of me.
The 33-year-old singer says there have been times in her career that she thought of leaving it all behind. But Leanne credits her longtime collaborator and friend, Daryl Brown, with getting her through the tough times. Leanne Rimes says she is in a good place and looks forward to the new album. The Story is out now as a single. The album is set for release later this year. In Washington, I'm David Byrd.
It's really nice to have Leanne Rimes back out among us, as if she ever went away, but a new album is certainly nice, and thank you, Dave, for that reporting, and thanks everyone for joining us here on The Voice of America for International Edition. It's always good to have you with us. Hope you'll stay tuned. The latest world news is straight ahead. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Jimmy Cook, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. We hope you have a great Friday.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
At the mention of violent extremism, groups like Al-Qaeda and ISIL and regions like the Middle East usually come to mind. But according to Sarah Sewell, Undersecretary for Civilian Security, Democracy, and Human Rights, violent extremism is on the rise in Africa, in East Africa, West Africa, the Sahel, and the Maghreb. The terrorists often try to justify their depravity with religion.
Many violent extremists harness religious claims to cloak their depravity and to inspire and recruit followers. And sadly, acts of violence in the name of religion are as old as religion itself, and they persist in communities around the world, from so-called honor killings to wife burnings.
Lately, we are seeing a new, highly dangerous trend, said Undersecretary Sewell, the rise of organized, heavily armed, non-state actors that justify violence and territorial ambitions with religious ideologies. Groups including Al-Shabaab, Boko Haram, Al-Qaeda in the Maghreb, and the LRA, the Lord's Resistance Army, threaten Africa's every achievement and aspiration. For Africa's future and for global security, they must be defeated, said Undersecretary Sewell. Across the African continent, the United States trains and equips foreign militaries, shares intelligence, and supports police to improve border security. These are well-known elements of our counterterrorism approach in Africa. But we must also attend to the other part of the equation, preventing the next generation of threat from emerging. We do this through our Countering Violent Extremism Effort, or CVE. CVE stresses the importance of good governance and the engagement of civil society, particularly community and religious leaders, as well as strengthening ties between governments and the communities they serve. In the last 2 years, the U.S. government has helped lead a shift toward this more localized and preventative approach to violent extremism in Africa and around the world. At the global level, we are helping governments, international NGOs, and multilateral bodies establish counter-messaging centers, develop CVE strategies, engage civil society, and share best practices. The U.S. government has also helped establish networks of researchers, young people, and municipal leaders to support each other in the shared struggle against violent extremism. The damage wrought by violent extremists measures not only in the blood they spill, but the investments they deter, the textbooks they burn, the women and girls they enslave, the vast human potential they squander, said Undersecretary Sewell. This is a struggle for the future of countless communities across Africa.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
It's for what's the universe?